Hi, this is Patti LuPone.
This is Allison Janney.
This is Matt Ballmer.
This is Donna Murphy.
This is Nia Vardalos.
This is Jesse Tyler Ferguson.
This is Beanie Feldstein.
I'm Octavia Spencer.
This is Ben Platt, and you're listening to Little Known Facts with my favorite person on the planet, Alana Levine.
A-OK.
Welcome to Little Known Facts, a podcast where you will hear unfiltered, raw, honest, and uniquely funny interviews with artists you love as they talk about the art they love to make. I'm your host, Ilana Levine.
You know, some people enjoy composing their own music, chord by chord, and others are happiest when they come across that one perfect song. Work is not a lot different than that. Whether you prefer building your own workflow or using a pre-made template, with Monday.com, you and the team can work in a way that's comfortable for everyone. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com and build your own amazing workflow or find an awesome template. No judgment.
Hey, I heard you needed inspiration. Here's Alana and friends with some revelations. Little known fact of the day. Every little thing's gonna be A-OK.
Hey everyone, new episodes of Little Known Facts drop every Monday and you can find them on your favorite podcast provider. Also, if you go to the website, littleknownfactspodcast.com, you'll find behind-the-scenes photos, videos, and interviews and lots more on the gallery page. And if you are loving these intimate, candid conversations with all the artists who come on the show, please head over to the contributions page. I depend on these donations to continue to bring you these interviews every week. So if you love the show, please donate. Hey, everyone. After a short hiatus, we are back and decided to start with something a little different. There are so many inspiring, hilarious audition, maybe I should call them horror stories, that many of my guests have shared that I wanted to put together in sort of a best of compilation situation, because I think as I went back and listened to them, not only are they hilarious, they are awe-inspiring, because every one of these people, after the story they have shared, got up and did it again. And I think that all artists are so brave to keep putting themselves out there and making themselves vulnerable. But I realize that that just translates to all of us, no matter what career path we're on. There are many obstacles and hurdles in our way. And the trick is not how to handle those highs, but how do we get back up on the horse when these things really throw us. As I looked back at our huge catalog of audition stories, I think I've chosen some of the best ones. There are many, many more, and I will continue to pepper the next season of podcasts with some of these at different times, because they will make you laugh so hard and inspire you just as hard. So enjoy.
A-OK. A-OK.
The first one that we're going to share is Molly Ringwald, who tells one of the best audition stories I've ever heard about a film that she was auditioning for to star in with Matthew Broderick. So here's Molly Ringwald. Get ready.
Some people I know just refuse to audition, won't do it, and then they just don't get parts, or, you know. And I continue to do it because I think if you are an actor, if you call yourself an actor, it's part of it. You should, you know, you do it. But yeah, there's been horrible auditions that I've done. In fact, a really bad audition I had to do with Matthew Broderick. And it was after we were going to do that movie together. And so then it was really kind of humiliating to be the one that was auditioning. And it was this French director, and then the script was really funny, I thought. It was called, like, Welcome to Buzzsaw or something. Uh-huh. And it was written by somebody you might actually know. It was Matthew's friend, Josh
Kenny?
Golden.
Oh, Josh. Okay.
And so this French director sort of took it over and decided that he wanted to rewrite. And there was something that they decided that they wanted to do in the audition. And I was already thrown because my ego was just going crazy that I was in this position at all. And then he said, oh, I thought it would be really fun. Or I thought it would be very funny if right now he takes the he puts like a dog
collar around your neck, and he pulls you like a dog. You know, it's and I was listening to him just like, oh yeah, yeah. I mean, okay, yeah, sure. It sounds interesting, just in theory, right? And then I look over and Matthew has this collar, and he just looks like so uncomfortable, like. And I'm just looking at him, and I felt like our eyes connected, and I'm just like, don't do this, you know? And then another part of me is like, you should just get up and walk out right now. You should just walk out. And then the other part of me is going, but you're an actor, you know, don't do. And I just had the millions of thoughts just racing through my brain as this collar was being put on my neck.
Oh my God.
And then I think like, I couldn't read. I couldn't think. I didn't know what my name was. Like, all I could think about was, I have to get out of this room right now. I'm going to like hyperventilate,
right,
or something.
Right. As you're sitting there.
Yeah. As I'm sitting there. Needless to say, I did not get that part.
Many of you might already know this, but when you finish graduate school as an actor, there are these massive auditions. Think of a convention center, hundreds and hundreds of young actors getting to do an audition for the regional theaters from all over the United States, and much like an open casting call. And on this particular interview with Roger Bart, who you know from a huge Broadway resume, from Disaster, the musical, to The Producers, Your Good Man Charlie Brown, Desperate Housewives, among others on television, he shares with us his Erta audition story.
They like me. I think they're swell. Isn't it remarkable how things turn out so well?
Way back when I graduated college, which was 84, 85, we had these things called ERTAs. And ERTAs were basically an audition a lot of people fresh out of college went to let regional theaters sort of become aware of you.
Right. A meet and greet of your talent.
Right. And you get to do the dreaded monologue.
Okay.
And now, I was never a good monologuist. And actually, to this day, I think a lot of actors probably aren't good monologuists, because most of the time, actors are not asked to stand alone and on stage and do speeches. Really, just is unusual. So there were about three or four panelists there, and they take copious notes during your audition. And I did my monologues. And then this is the kind of cowardly part on their part. About a week later, you get their scribble on their pieces of paper in the mail with their response to you. And either three or four of them, all of them said in varying degrees of politeness, get out. Do yourself a favor and do us a favor and do showbiz a favor and retire now at the precious age of 22. Don't even bother. You have no talent. That was one of my first big auditions. So those of you out there, don't be deterred by the first times that you go out and you sort of stumble, because I stumbled big time and I knew who I was already. So it didn't. I kind of ripped them up and thought, fuck them.
Not bad. Not bad at all. I wonder if it will snow tonight.
So the great Noah Emmerich from FX's The Americans shares his story of how he got the job.
You know, I did this audition, whatever you call it, audition. I mean, it's a polite term, it's chemistry, but it's really just an audition.
Right.
Where you make a tape. They were filming it so that the network brass in California could look at it, which is actually the kinder version. Sometimes you have to go into a room with all the people there watching you. This
it's
is
better
sort of
to
private
not have to see them.
With the director and the cast and just making this little chemistry read. And I did it, and a couple of the executives were there. And there, everyone was like, this is great. You know, it's formality. Welcome to the show. This is so great. We can't wait to start. And then called me up the next day and they said, so we have a little bit of an issue, which is that the sound didn't record on your tape. So can you come back and do it again? That's like, I mean, I've never had a call like that in my entire career, that you do an audition, that it goes so well, that everyone says, great, you got it, just make it form, you know, send it to LA. And then they call back and say, you know what, we forgot to press record on the audio track. So I went back and they recorded. In fact, when I went back, I played a little prank, which was when I started doing it, I went, it won't work on radio, but I was like.
Okay, just for listeners, he's moving his mouth and not making sound.
So I did the whole first scene like that. I think that's what got me the job.
That's hilarious. Have you had to audition again for anything in any form since the show?
All the time.
You do?
I mean, it depends. Yeah. I don't think auditioning ever stops if you're interested in stretching beyond how you're already perceived. I mean, it's easier to not audition for the roles that you've already played. But if I want to do something, a comedic or, you know, a character that they haven't seen me play before, and they say, well, how can he do that? We need to see it. And I understand that. But other than that, I mean, I have no problem. I understand auditioning completely. It's a mistake to take it as a reflection of people's respect for you or their embrace of you or their belief in you even. As a director myself, if I wanted to cast you far from anything I'd ever seen you do before, I would just be curious to see how you fit in, just for both of our sakes.
Well, why can't it just be enough that I say I can?
You have to own your own process and not have it be vulnerable to other people's process. As weird as that sounds, you know. So the truth is, yes, I've had many auditions where I go into the room and the person doesn't even look at you. They're reading their
mail.
Or
Woody Allen, literally. Have you ever read for him?
I have read for Woody Allen once.
He's quite often under the table, right? Or like kind of his back half turned to you, and you're like, can he see me?
Very awkward.
I'm sorry, is he? And it's so painful that you do actually just want to take care of him and be like, you know what, don't worry about this. How can I help? How can I help you?
I have to say, I've done some casting on The Americans.
Under the table.
It is excruciating. Knowing the state of mind of the actors coming in, I find it excruciatingly hard to be on the other side of the table. I don't want to be in that seat. Like I'm with you guys. I'm an actor. Like I and yet you do only have 45 minutes to see 12 people.
So have you watched anyone just completely bomb? Like unravel?
There's been some close calls. The idea is you want them to be everyone. It's the paradox of auditioning is that the best work comes from a relaxed, playful, free spirit.
Right.
And you know that doesn't happen when you have a minute and 15 seconds to show them your stuff, and there's five people sitting behind a desk, and you're on. It's just the most awkward, awful circumstance.
And I'm proud to be an American, where at least I know I'm free. And I won't forget the men who died, who gave that right to me, and I gladly stand up.
Dan Fogler of Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them fame shares his story of how he went from really not working in the way that he wanted to be working for quite a while to finding himself in the middle of the epic J.K. Rowling film. Listen up.
I definitely got the golden ticket. Mm-hmm. I won the lottery.
Do you feel that now because you're in this J.K. Rowling movie, or you felt that
all
along?
Well, because I thought that in order to even get into the fucking door to have an audition for this, where I was at a year ago, I would have to have done this specific movie in order to get to that movie, in order to get to the next movie, in order to even dream about getting into the door with the director.
So how did this happen?
I auditioned, and thank God, I just was in a philosophical and an emotional state. Having just had my kid, you realize, oh, that's why I'm killing myself to put food on the table. So then it doesn't feel much like killing yourself anymore. You know, you have more strength, you have more energy. You find it somewhere. And
really, I'm just really tired. But I love it. I love that it works that way for you.
For auditions.
Yes.
You find it.
Yeah. You know, well, there's a hunger in that way again.
And there's a huge emotional well that opens up when your kid is born, that now, oh my God, you know, basically as an actor, your spectrum just grows.
So when you audition for this kind of film, do they let you see the script?
They gave me like three scenes to look at. And I went in there and I was like, oh, wow, this is like me basically playing my great grandfather. you know, who
Jacob.
Yeah.
Right.
Who was a baker on the Lower East Side.
Are you on tape the first time? Are you reading for David
Yates?
Yeah. You're on tape.
I was on tape in New York for the New York casting director. And I put together like this. I was like, oh, shit. J.K. Rowling. Oh, my God. I gotta.
Even I've heard of her.
I know her.
Yes.
I have to get my act together here. And I put together like a costume.
I
thought would work.
Yeah.
It's nothing like what I wear.
It's not what you're wearing in the film.
But I found this amazing hat. It was like a patchwork like hat. I was like, this is very much in the wizarding world. I had suspenders. I had cut off gloves. You know, they saw that and they were like, oh, okay, this guy cares.
Great. Barnum. What's happening?
I don't know. It was like Newsies. I was doing Newsies.
At least you made the effort.
But I made the effort. Totally. I came in there. I made a choice.
Yes.
And I think they saw that I was incredibly close, and this character was just in my blood. But
did you see your competition?
Well, I did afterward. Yeah. I mean, Jesus Christ, it was everyone in the world.
Like who else?
So, like, I didn't hear anything after that audition. I was like, okay, that was nice.
Guess I can return that hat to Abracadabra.
Exactly. And then everybody and their grandmother, you know, auditioned. Krasinski, you know, I think, you know, Jack Black, everyone in the world.
Yeah.
Josh Gad, like... But, like, all different shapes and sizes. I guess it was actors that could do funny but also have a heart. David Yates' wife, Yvonne. David was like, I really like him, you know? But, you know, who the fuck is this guy, you know?
Yes.
I have to see everybody else.
Yes.
But Yvonne, his wife, saw the tape and was just like, this is the guy. You have to, and thank God for her
Yvonne.
Tugging on his sleeve every
darling.
Night, going, that's the guy, darling.
Yes, darling, did you see? Wake up.
Yeah, and they circle back to me, thank God. So I went out to L.A. and auditioned with him.
Did you wear the hat?
I brought the whole damn outfit again.
Because you're supposed to wear the same thing to the exactly. callback so they know who you are.
I did. Oh, it was ridiculous. Okay. He was like, maybe not the hat, you know. And then I got rid of the hat.
Of course. What hat? Oh, my God. Is this on?
Suspenders, maybe. But the suspenders, they were the kind that kept on, like, unclicking and flipping up. So that
Ow.
Was it. Ow.
Oh, right in the left eye.
Oh.
Sorry, Mr. Yates.
Yeah. But I got out of that audition, and I was like, damn, I nailed that. He was wiping away a tear.
I am Jacob Kowalski.
And said it just in that voice. Yeah. I am
Jacob Kowalski.
I am Jacob Kowalski.
Did you do it as Pacino?
I did. The first time I did it, I walked in, and I was like, get out of the fucking way. I'm a baker. I'm making all sorts of pastries for you.
So my guess is you didn't do Pacino at your David Yates audition.
No,
for
right. Thanks for bringing me
Fantastic
back
Beasts. But you did do something special.
I did. I obviously did, because then they brought me out to London and they did screen tests.
You go to London and you
can
do screen like makeup and the whole thing and costume.
They did screen tests with. I think I even brought my costume to that screen test. I think
hat.
I did the hat.
Like, that hat's going to be in the Smithsonian, goddammit. Dan Fogler wing.
And that's when I met Reddy Edmain.
Reddy Edmain, which all his good friends call. You're so inside.
I am.
Reddy Edmain.
Good old Reddy. Eddie Redmayne. And the cast is delicious. I saw the film.
Did you read Harry Potter stuff?
I saw all the movies. And I never read those books. They're really heavy.
They're big.
Yeah.
Even your Kindle gets heavier. This is a huge movie.
Yeah.
You shoot in London. Is it all green screen?
You have elaborate sets and then just green screen in the places where they absolutely need it. So they're basically doing their best to keep you in this, in the moment. And, you know, you don't have to use your imagination for much at all. Putting the room together, it's there.
But like if Eddie is climbing into a suitcase,
yeah.
right, and
mm-hmm.
going into it, which I think you observe him doing.
Yeah.
How do they do that?
That's magic.
It's actual magic.
It's actual magic.
And wizardry.
They have a jar. It's like a glowing, magical jar of dust. So it's like
right.
fairy dust, I guess.
Does J.K. throw it at you?
J.K. is the one who knows the combination for the safe that has the jar. They go pull out the jar, and they take a scoop.
Totally.
And they put it on the scenes.
And that's how it works. The magic happens when she throws the fairy dust on you.
pretty much.
It's not so much your talent and your lifelong everything that brought you to this moment. It's just that. Now, is she like, you know, like in The Witness Protect, like when those people are on like testifying and so you just hear their voice and there's like their faces are all pixelated.
Yeah.
Is she on set and like accessible? And
first of all, to answer your question, there's no bottom to the suitcase. There was a hole in the ground.
Okay.
That's how it came out.
I thought it was very cool. Yeah. Yes. Yes.
No, it's an amazing moment when he's like perfectly.
Because I've tried
timed.
That like a million times and I can never like walk into the suitcase in quite that way.
Yeah, they really perfected it. They put stairs and everything down there.
There's like a suitcase guy.
Yeah.
Just a guy on set just for the suitcase.
Oh yeah, yeah.
For
making it look right.
Was this the biggest movie you've ever been in?
It's the biggest movie that John Voight has ever been in.
Okay. So that gives us context.
Yeah.
How will you go back now? Like, how do you live a normal life now once that's been your life?
How am I doing? Am I okay? Do I seem normal?
It was weird when, like, your people came in and they were carrying you, like, kind of like on this weird throne?
Yeah, it's like a
golden throne?
Chalice?
Yeah.
Yeah, you ever seen... I wanted them to model it after
yeah.
The Egyptian king from the movie 300.
That's kind of what it looked like to me.
Yeah.
And I didn't even see that movie or even know what you're talking about. But that's what it looks
but
like.
But that's what it evokes.
Give us one or two moments that you'll never forget from making that movie.
Oh, my God.
Starting with when you found out you got it.
Okay, so when I found out I got it, it was a beautiful moment. Because when I did my screen test, they said, okay, so we're probably going to do a million more screen tests. And I was like, okay.
With me?
No, yeah.
Oh, not with
or
me.
Somebody?
Got it. Okay.
So they said, if you hear, you're going to be coming back to London for another screen test. So I was like, okay. So I'm at Comic-Con last year, and I have my boxes of Brooklyn Gladiator, which is my little comic book that I've been working
on the side.
What's your reason for being here, Dan?
My little comic book.
Right.
So I'm like schwitzing,
right.
Pulling these boxes through this like swimming upstream through costumed, sweaty people who I love. But at that moment, I'm like, get out of my way.
This is what's happened.
And I get a call.
Yeah.
And I'm like the Hunchback of Notre Dame, and I pick up the phone, and it's my manager who says, hey, where are you right now? And I go, I'm trying to make my way through Comic-Con right now. And they're like, oh.
I'm peddling my wares.
Yeah. They said, guess what? Comic-Con's going to be a lot different next year. And then I suddenly started hearing the Superman theme. It was all boop, 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 boop. And then I started, my posture got better, and then a single tear came down my eye, and it went blink, and I actually heard the blink. And then I just started handing out comic books, going, who wants Brooklyn Gladiator for free?
A magic fort, take me to the final round. A magic fort, I barely lifted off the ground. A magic fort. I do it without making a sound.
Continuing with more American audition horror stories, the beloved Asif Manvi, that we all know from Jon Stewart's The Daily Show, was an actor bumming around, doing some regional theater, some small parts on television shows, and going through a heartbreak when he got the call that it was now or never to go audition for a segment on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. Wasn't sure if he was going to go, decided to. We're glad he did. Here's Asif.
I was not a particularly political actor, whatever that means.
Yeah.
Before The Daily Show. I was a working actor. I basically was just, I was doing, you know, I had a nice little career
yes.
going on, like regional theater and
yes.
plays and
getting parts on TV
parts
shows.
On TV and movies and whatever. Yeah. And it was all very good. And then I got this audition for The Daily Show and I got it. And it's actually all in my book, you can read about
it. Oh, I've read it. I could tell the entire story right now.
Yeah, good, good.
You were very sad about a girlfriend.
Yes.
You were, I think I might know which girlfriend it is.
I think you do, yes.
Because I think I know her, and she was your girlfriend when we worked together.
Right, that's right.
And she was engaged.
Yes.
And you were blue.
And I was blue, and I was writing this letter, and then I got this call.
To her.
To her.
Even though she was engaged.
I know.
Maybe married.
It was sad. It kind of
did you send it?
I did send it, but yeah. I sent it for me.
Sure.
You know, I had to do it.
You sent it to yourself.
I sent it to
and I have it. I have the letter right here.
I sent
here.
It to you.
Got
just
it.
Just to, like, read, and then you never forwarded it.
I didn't.
I think that it gave me a kind of, can I swear on here?
Yes.
Yeah, it gave me a kind of.
This is
of,
never going to go anywhere. This is just you and me talking. Don't worry about it.
I think I gave it a sort of, it gave my audition, and this is something for all you young actors out there, when you don't give a fuck.
Mm-hmm.
You often give your best performance. You know this, right?
How do you manufacture that, though?
Yes,
that's
exactly.
That's the trick.
So how do you get that, like, I don't give a fuck?
When you cannot pay your rent.
Right.
Without and this job.
Exactly. So it's like a question of, like, how do you, like, not come in there desperate and needy, which is what you are.
Yeah.
And pretend, you know. But luckily, because of this situation where I was writing this letter and
you
feeling blue, I really didn't give a fuck.
Were you a fan? Did you watch The Daily
Show? Yeah, I did.
Okay.
I did. But I didn't think for one instance that I was going to get this part.
Right.
I was doing it as like a sort of like way to like get out of my head, you know?
Get off that park bench.
Get off that. Exactly. So I was like, I'm just going to go
in front of her
and
house before the cops came.
How do you know that?
I read the book.
So anyway, I go down there and I'm like, yeah, you know, I'll just do this. Whatever. It'll be another audition. And then I booked it. Like right there. And then I was on the show. And then my life kind of changed overnight.
Tell us how.
Well, John Stewart. Lovely man.
Is he all that?
He is great. I love John.
And is he all that?
No, he is.
I mean.
Let's keep editing that. Is he all that?
Is he all that?
Is he all that?
Just between you and me.
Between you and me. Is he all? No, he was. Look, I owe the whole thing to him. He was like, I'm hiring you. You're on the show. This is it. You're on tonight. And I was on that night. And
what was the first thing you had to do?
It was about the war in the Hezbollah-Israeli war in the Middle East. And it was like this very, I think it was still, I still feel like it was one of the best pieces I ever did on the show. It was one of those, it was written, you know, before I got there.
Right.
And it was just kind of powerful and pointed.
So I'm naive. Is there a teleprompter?
So
like, how did you do that?
This is the funny thing. I go show up there and they give me this script. They said, okay, so you'll be going in and reading with John. And I get this script and it's like 3 pages and it's all me. And I'm just like, holy shit. So I start like trying to memorize.
Right.
And I'm desperately trying to learn this because I'm like, you know, this is what I do and this is, I'm an actor. And then about a few minutes later, the girl comes in and she says, what are you doing? And she says, oh, they're ready to see you. And I said, oh, can I have a couple more minutes because I'm just trying to get this memorized. And she said, oh, no, you don't need to memorize it. There's a teleprompter. And at that point, I was just like, oh, a teleprompter?
This is,
what
I got it.
And I just threw the script over my shoulder, marched in.
Caution to the wind.
Like, I was like, threw my scarf over my left shoulder.
Yes.
And proceeded to just do my best Stephen Colbert impression.
John Slattery of Mad Men fame was one of those incredibly handsome actors who turned gray really young. Mostly that has worked for him and been his calling card, but on the rare occasion where that wasn't appropriate, his agents would ask him to do something about his hair. Listen up as you hear one of the most hilarious audition stories you will ever hear from John Slattery.
I have a story.
All right.
That is an audition story, if that's what you want. I have the best. I hadn't lived here very long. I was staying at my sister's apartment on the Upper East Side, and because I didn't have any money to, you know, pay my own rent. And she was, I was sort of living out, I was out at night, and she was up early in the morning, so she had gone off to work. And I got a call from my manager, and he said, there's a Sylvester Stallone movie that they want to read you for, but you're too Irish looking. I'm worried about this, and I want you to dye your hair. So I said, okay, what color? What? And he goes, black, dummy. So I said, okay. And he goes, go down to the drugstore and get one of those things and dye your hair. The audition's in an hour and 20 minutes. It's like July 13th. It's 400 degrees. It's Manhattan. You know, it's a horrible, humid summer day in Manhattan. And I go down to the Dwayne Reed or whatever it was, get the stuff, come back, and I notice some guys digging a trench in the street out in front of her apartment. And go in upstairs, put the shit in my hair, which is, you know, like black syrup, if you ever see this stuff. And you put it in there, and you're supposed to just leave it in there for a while, and you have these little gloves that, mm-hmm. that are the size of a small woman's hand.
Right.
And those... And
your proctologist gloves.
Yeah, you put them on little, tiny little plastic gloves that you put on, and they tear, and so you've got this shit all over your hands. And then you're supposed to... There's a little plastic bonnet that you put on. And I remember this because my mother used to dye her own hair back in the day, you know, at home, and she'd walk around with this plastic little cap on, little see-through thing. So I had that on for the requisite time, and I'm looking, you know, learning my lines and being nervous because,
right.
you know, I didn't have beta blockers then, so
no.
I was just a nervous idiot with this shit in my hair and this little plastic cap on my head. And then I, like, you know, 10 minutes goes by, whatever, and then I, okay, time to get this stuff off. And I turn the water on, and the water goes, go, you know, that noise where there's no water in the pipes. And I was like, what? And I realized it's the guys in the street. They shut the water off because they're digging a trench in the street. And so I run to the other end of the apartment, throw the window open, and I'm like, you know, shirtless with this plastic hood on my head and this shit rolling down my ears. I'd be like, hey, fellas, when can I expect to have the water
Young
turned
man.
Back on? And they're like, tomorrow, Agnes. And I was like, oh, thank you. And I'm like, oh, shit, what am I going to do? And there's no water, so I go into the refrigerator, and first of all, I'm thinking I stick my head in the toilet, and I wasn't that desperate,
right?
And I thought, oh, I gotta, there's gonna be water, maybe there's water in the fridge or something. So there was like a, you know, a plastic bottle of water. I take off all my clothes, I pour the water on myself in the bathtub, and now it's just thinned this stuff out enough so that it's all over my body. And it's still, you know, it's still like paste in my hair. and as I get out of the thing, go back, and there's a Jogger's bottle of water. So I squirt that on my, and then like a bottle of seltzer. And then I have enough, and I go, and I'm like, this isn't going to work. I go, my sister's laundry quarters is all, there's like a little cup full, put on my clothes, run down to that store, get a couple of bottles of water, come back in, and, you know, little liter bottles of Evian, and get back in the tub. Get this stuff just off of my head area. I don't care if it was all over my body. I was just going to put on long sleeves and button the shirt all the way up.
In July,
of course. So I do that, and I get it just off. I'm standing in the tub looking over by the sink because, you know, the mirror above the sink, so that I can just see myself enough to know that I don't have it on my head. So I get it off of my head, but it's still literally dripping down my sides, the sides of my head. And I go to the audition, and the audition, if I could only remember this casting director's name, she was crazy, and she would get into it. She was literally like, and it was, the scene was Sylvester Stallone's brother.
Okay.
Who was the sort of ne'er-do-well brother. He sly is always having to get out of a jam. This jam was that I had borrowed some money from some loan shark or something, and this guy was going to publicly humiliate me by making me give him a
what doesn't kill us makes us stronger.
Right, so I'm doing this scene for the casting director and I don't know, some other people, and I got this shit dripping down the sides of my head. I'm literally like, I got like a nervous tick, like keep wiping my ears and my side, my and this woman is playing the part of the gangster, and she's coming around the desk, and she's standing in front of me, and I'm dropped to my knees, like, no, don't make me do it, Charlie, don't make, or whatever. And she's going, you're gonna do it, you know, whatever the lines were. And I remember having a distinct out of body experience. I flew up to the corner of the room, and I looked down on myself, you know, holding the script, wiping the shit off of my hair and my ears, this woman pretending to be a gangster telling me to give her a and I was just like, wow, this is what a weird day. That's all I could think. I was like, this is very weird. And then I got up and left, and I did not get the part.
They never made the
movie.
What was the feedback?
The movie was, the feedback was that I was too Irish. Literally, that was it went well. They were like, it went pretty well. They don't believe that you're going to be Sylvester Stallone's brother. And that movie turned out to be Rocky III.
Jimmy, head with hair, long, beautiful hair, shining, gleaming, steaming, flaxen, waxen. Give me dime of fair hair.
Connie Shulman's an old friend of mine. We were in acting class together in New York City when we were both starting out. Decided after she had kids that she was going to take a hiatus from her career. And she raised her kids. And when her son was around 15 years old, she decided she wanted to dip her toe again in the water of acting. And she went through her Rolodex, and I believe it was still a Rolodex. That's how long it had been since she had acted, and found the number of an agent that she had worked with before she had kids, and said, hey, I want to try this again. So her first or second audition was for a little show called Orange is the New Black. And all she knew was that she was auditioning for a character who was called Yoga Jones and was a yoga instructor. So here's Connie telling the story of how she ended up as Yoga Jones on Orange is the New Black.
The animals, trap, trap, trap till the cage is full. And everyone is waiting, waiting on you, and you've got time.
You called me a couple of years ago, and you're like, you know what? I think I want to try this again. And I was like, oh, that's adorable. Connie wants to dip her toe back in the water. Maybe she'll get a voiceover for, you know, Clearasil. And the next thing I know, it's like, Connie Shulman is the new star of Orange is the New Black. Can you tell me about the audition process for Yoga Jones and how this came together?
Well, okay, so it had been a really long time since I had auditioned for anything. And my kids were starting to become actors, and I was taking them on some things. And I thought, you know what, I'm gonna see if there's anybody out there that remembers me. You know, so I was trying to dig up an agent.
Did you go door to door like, hi, can I have a Jehovah's Witness?
It was almost like that.
Can I leave some information?
Stop. It was seriously looking through like a Rolodex. I think we actually had one. And I'm looking through there and I have an old friend who now sort of worked his way up, now runs his own agency. So I did the thing where I called him. I said, I want to pick your brain. I go to lunch. I basically begged him to sort of just
keep an eye out for something that might be right for you.
You know, he said, look, Connie, headshots are now in color. You might want to update. Everything's done online.
What?
You know, it was sort of like he was bringing me up 15 years into technology. Because I had
You're like Brie Larson. You'd been in a room. You'd been in a
I was in the crib with my son, Ephraim, for 15 years. So then he sort of updated me. I pestered him for about 2 months. He said, what's going on? It was the second audition I had. He said, here, something's come in. It's a yoga teacher. Netflix had just started
Netflix
what they were doing.
Netflix is on your computer. He explained to you what Netflix was.
Netflix to us was getting the movies in the mail.
Right.
And never finding them or turning them back in. And so, you know, he sort of explained to me what that was. And then I went in for this yoga teacher. And what I remember was that the sides were remarkable. Uh-huh. It was beautiful writing. Uh-huh. Like you knew right away. I mean, even I knew that after not having auditioned for a long time.
Having not read for 15 years.
I mean, you know, some Dr. Seuss maybe. But this was like, yeah, on the par with him. So I go in there and there are, you know, 25, 30 women, all different types, all wearing their version of what a yoga outfit was. And went in there, read with the casting person, and that was it. And I remember I had gone out to lunch with my friend who's the agent, and he had forgotten his phone, and he was really distracted the entire lunch. And as soon as we left, I went home. He called. He said, "I've found my phone. They want you for that part." There was no callback. There was no nothing. That was it. I kind of freaked out because I thought I wanted to go back and test this out, but right. I wasn't expecting to get anything. But it was shot in New York, and it all seemed doable. The thing that was really funny was I go to the wardrobe fitting, and the woman's pulling out all these, like, sort of beige, horrible sweatpants, and I had gone there thinking, you know, Lululemon, totally. Perhaps. Totally. How cute am I going to look?
Maybe Kate Hudson's new line of yoga exactly. wear would be adorable.
Like, how good am I going to look
right.
on this show?
Not only my back.
But I'm coming
I'm a
back
yoga in a bit, instructor.
Coming back in a big way. And yeah. I was like, why are you? I was like, oh, I was thinking something tighter. And she's like, well, you're an inmate.
I'm sorry.
And I'm like, no, I'm the yoga teacher. I come, I teach yoga, I leave. They're like, no, you don't leave. Like, I had not read anything. So I was under the impression I came and went. It wasn't until the wardrobe fitting that somebody told me that I was actually in prison.
Tumble out of bed and I stumble to the kitchen. Pour myself a cup of ambition and yawn and stretch and try to come to life.
Mary Stuart Masterson, 80s icon, tells us in her interview about how really she got her first acting part. Her dad was well known already for having written the musical The Best Little Whorehouse in Texas. She lived in New York City, surrounded by a lot of artists. Her mom was an actress too. And so one day there was a knock on the door, and the director of The Stepford Wives, a film that her dad was going to be in, appeared at the door while her dad was indisposed. And this is the tale of how Mary Stuart got her first job as a kid.
My husband spins fantasies. He lives them, then gives them to you all. While he was...
As the story goes, you were homesick from school when your dad was filming The Stepford Wives.
Yeah, my dad was actually working the director. They were going to sort of work on the script because my father was in that movie. He was the lead actor who puts Catherine Ross into a robotic state.
Right.
So he was having a meeting with the director, but I was home from school, and my father was in the bathroom. And so I received the director. I opened the door. I invited him in. It was like 9 o'clock in the morning.
Right.
And I offered him a gin and tonic.
Of course he did, because that's how the Mastersons do
know,
it.
I was seven, and right. I think he was
hilarious.
I don't know. I guess he thought that was a good thing. Precocious, at least.
Right.
So
apparently that was your audition.
So that was my audition. That was my audition, I guess.
So yeah. You did crafts. So you basically made drinks and played this little girl on the
film. I got him drunk. I sat him down on the couch.
Like the reverse casting couch.
Yes. And then I told him, and then I said, my dad, and then I yelled, "Dad, get out of the bathroom."
Right. Really, which I'm sure didn't embarrass
polite.
Him at all.
No. I said, "He's indisposed."
He's indisposed. Would you like more lime? Hilarious. And they needed a kid, and there you were.
I
perfect.
Don't remember if he actually had me make the gin and tonic. I just remember offering it to him.
Either way, you got the job.
Yeah, I got the job. It was a very bizarre mixed blessing, too, because I remember at the time feeling very conflicted about it because I was the middle child, and
right.
I felt like if I said – my parents gave me the option because it was going to be during the summer.
Right.
And they said, you have to decide whether you want to do this or not. And I have like two lines in the movie.
Right.
So it's not like a lead. It's not like right. a Haley Joel Osment
okay.
moment. I
okay.
didn't have any talent.
You didn't
I was
see dead people. It
no.
didn't center on your character.
I was a total stiff as okay. an actress, totally uncomfortable in front of the camera. That's the truth.
Okay.
But there I was with this freighted with this decision of what to do. And my parents said, just, well, we're going out to dinner tonight. Just leave a note on our bed when you decide what to do. And I wrote a smiley face with dollar signs for eyes because I felt like if I said it was about I have to do it because of the money,
right.
that was okay.
Right. Like you're going to help your family buy more gin.
I'm going
to keep the gin and tonic.
Gin budget.
Right.
So I don't know that I felt like really bad. Like if I get it and you know, my sister doesn't get it or my brother was too little, but like
right.
that's not fair.
So why me? Why am I
me?
Being chosen?
Yeah. And really it was just a random thing in
right.
all honesty. But So I remember feeling really weirdly guilty and strange about it. But I said, yes.
Right. You wanted those dollar eyeballs.
I wanted those big dollars, those big bucks.
Sure. I'm sure that was a whopping $300 a day.
Oh, yeah.
Money makes the world go around, the world go around, the world go around. Money makes the world go around, it makes the world go round.
So Brian Greenberg of One Tree Hill fame was up for one of his first movies called The Perfect Score. And it's a real testament how sometimes an agent or a manager can get us in the door again when it doesn't go as we had hoped the first time. And in this anecdote, Brian tells the story of how he was cast in The Perfect Score.
I don't want to be anything other than what I've been trying to be lately. All I have to do is think of me and I peace of mind.
I went and auditioned for The Perfect Score to play like the best friend role. And I didn't go very well because I'm not the strongest auditioner.
You're not a great best friend.
I'm a good best friend. I'm just bad at showing in a 2-minute audition. And then Ellen was friendly with the casting director, Kathy Sandridge. And she said, you got to see Brian. She's like, well, he wasn't funny. She's like, he's funny. He can
right.
do it.
Give him another
so
shot.
So she fought for me to do another shot.
That's
I went
so
in there
nice.
And I nailed it.
That's
right?
amazing. And so, did you know it at the time?
Yeah. Like, I was improvising. I was doing it. I was just having fun with it. And then they wanted to test this actor, Emil Hirsch, who's a great actor, but for the lead role. But he looked really young. So Paramount wanted to test him. And so this was like this is the only time I've ever done this where they hired. I got a call. They're like, they want to hire you for the day to play opposite Emil Hirsch. And you don't have the role. They're going to pay you like $800, which was, to me, my rent.
Already
like,
a
this
win.
This is awesome.
Yeah, that and a good bottle of wine.
You get to do those scenes with another actor, but they're testing the other actor. It's not about you. I was like, okay.
That's so strange.
Yeah, it was like a real old Hollywood kind of test, you know?
And hair and makeup.
Hair and makeup, wardrobe. We did it on the lot of Paramount. And to me, it was like no pressure because it wasn't really about me.
That's amazing.
So
did Emil seem nervous?
He was great. You know, the problem with Emil was it wasn't his talent. I think he just looked so young.
So he didn't get it.
He did not get it because he just looked so, I mean, they tried to put a black leather jacket on him. He just looked too young.
They're doing that weird like baby powder in his hair. We're gray him up a little bit.
But yeah, so it was a get for me. And like they show the test. They're like, he looks too young. I think Emil looks young, but Brian works in that role. And so I kind of snuck in, you know,
That's the back door
and got it. And then, you know, Chris Evans ended up getting that role. But the writer of that movie was Mark Schwann, and he went on to create One Tree Hill, and we had a really good working relationship, and he said, I got a role for you.
Don't ask me who I am. Don't ask me where I stand. Don't ask me what's my plan.
We all know Matthew Broderick from Ferris Bueller fame, but what you didn't know is that Matthew almost passed on that iconic part that has been making people happy for decades. So in this story, Matthew tells us how he almost didn't do Ferris Bueller's Day Off and why. Here's Matthew.
I have a secret desire hiding deep in my soul. It sets my heart afire to see me in this world.
Did you audition for that movie, or did they just how did you get that movie? That was a great job to get.
They just sent it to me. I was doing the play of Biloxi Blues, and, you know, War Games had come out. I just was sent it, and I'm still a little like this. I was like, John Hughes, which one is John Hughes?
Right.
You know, the idiot.
Secret,
and,
right, which one?
You know, what, 16 Candles again? Oh, all right. And I rented 16 Candles and Breakfast Club and watched them, and I was like, oh, well, look at that. And then I read the script, and I thought, oh, this is kind of great. And I thought, at that time, every play I did, I seemed to talk to the audience. And even movies, I would somehow, they would say, talk to the audience. And then the script, you know, I was like, am I going to be somebody who just always, who am I, Bob Hope? So I had a little moment of, is this a good idea?
An existential crisis.
Yeah.
About it.
And then, but then my agent at the time, I remember, flew to, he was like, I'll be right there. When he heard me hesitate, he was like, He took he somehow transported. Yeah, like he suddenly was standing behind me. I was still on the phone, and he was like, "I just thought I'd come so we could talk about this." And I was not gonna not do that movie. So
guess what? Said, he was right.
Oh, absolutely.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to our compilation of American audition horror stories. So glad to be back with you. I've missed you terribly.
Clouds can make the wind blow. Bugs can make the grass grow. So there you go. These are little known facts that now you know.
Hey, everyone. Thank you so much for listening. If you want more information about my guests, go to the website littleknownfactspodcast.com. I also wanted to tell you that there is now a new addition to the website. It is a button that says contributions. This podcast is a true labor of love, and I really, really want to keep doing it for a long time. So if you like listening as much as I love to do it, please feel free to contribute. It would mean the world to me. Also, on Twitter, you can find me at Alana Levine. Instagram is Little Known Facts Podcast. And on Facebook, Little Known Facts Podcast. You can also feel free to rate and review the show on the iTunes show page. This podcast is recorded at Hangar Studios in New York City. This episode was brought to you by Pro Media. Located in Times Square, Pro Media offers both production and post-production services out of its beautiful studios in the heart of New York City. Pro Media, sound vision. Find out more at promedia.nyc.